Gentlemen, welcome to a beautiful Monday. We're going to open up public hearing on Senate Bill 636. Ask that Bill Perry come forward. And go ahead, Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 636 would delete timing of payment as a consideration in exempting hotel or motel operators from Oregon landlord-tenant laws. Hotel and motel operators and their lodgers are not generally considered landlords or tenants for the purposes of the rights and requirements under landlord-tenant law, but to be exempt, they have to meet three requirements. Senate Bill 636 would take away one of those requirements, which is payment not more than 6 days in advance. There are situations where this has created a problem. If you look at the bill, the changes are all on the page 4. And the two changes, the substantive changes, are lines 14 and line 16. And the changes below that, starting with vacation occupancy, are just housekeeping changes that all of in line 21, for instance, is not necessary because there's an and between the three items. So all the rest of the page is housekeeping, and again, the main changes are on lines 14 and 16, the substantive.
Thank you, Janet. Welcome, Mr. Perry.
Yep. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm here with the Oregon Lodging Association, and we are the introducers of 636. And just to give you an idea of the circumstances that have happened is, generally, when you or anybody else goes to a hotel, you will put down a credit card, and generally the hotel does not charge the credit card till after you leave, so you can stay there as long as you want. But there are different circumstances when, like the example that has been brought to us, a construction company has brought in a subcontractor, and they will say, I'll pay for your stay at a hotel, and they'll just write them a business check, and they'll stay for 2 weeks. Because of the way the landlord-tenant law is written, the method of payment will actually trigger landlord-tenant law. Since you pay for more than 6 days in advance, then all of a sudden they're triggered into landlord-tenant law and they're protected. And so what will happen is the 2 weeks will be done with the construction company, and the guy that came on as a worker will say, I like Oregon, I'll stay a couple extra days, go fishing. And so they will stay, and there's nothing that the hotel operator can do to remove them. And so basically what we did when we looked at this law was said there are standards when you look at this and both vacation properties that talk about actually the what I would say the components of the stay, maid service, length of time, and everything else. When you look at vacation, it doesn't talk anything about method of payment. It talks about are you a resident, what's your purpose of it, which we think are good standards. The only part of this is line 16 that is actually just technically a method of payment. And so if somebody stays there for more than 30 days, no matter how they pay, they should be, you know, I understand why they're included in landlord-tenant. But this one is the only one out of all these different definitions that actually just deals with the method of payment. And because of the method of payment, it really shrinks the time period to fall under landlord-tenant. It moves it. Vacation property, it's 45 days. In a hotel, it's 30 days. But because that method of payment's in there, it actually can shrink that to 6 days. And I just don't think that no matter what your purpose for staying there is, 6 days in a hotel should ever classify you as a tenant. I do think the daily maid service or up to 2 days of maid service and staying for 30 days are standards that are easy to determine everything else. And so really what we're trying to do is just say, you know, method of payment should not be a concern. Length of stay, reasons for stay, different things I provide as a lodging operator are all issues, but just a method of payment should not be. And I know there's going to be somebody up testify in opposition to the bill, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. Well, first of all, do you have some examples of a bill where this has proven to, in practice, to be a problem?
Yeah, Senator Metzger and members of the committee, I would say that this is just a very, very few select cases. And actually, it was a board member that hired an attorney, and I tried to get a hold of him Friday, and I haven't gotten a hold of him. He's in a court date, so I can probably get you a specific example. I will tell you, it does not happen that often. I do think it's starting to occur because I think people are just starting to kind of figure this out. But I would say it's been very rare cases from that standpoint up to now.
Okay. Questions? Senator Monis-Henderson.
What would prevent you so that how much of a problem would it be if you would just pay for 6 days at a time rather than the full 2 weeks or the full...
Senator Metzger, Senator Melissa Anderson, the issue is different from this case and from you or I staying in a motel, as it's actually a, in most of the cases that we've had, it's a third party paying. And so generally, if somebody is coming up for 2 weeks, that generally it's kind of the security you're providing for that person that came up here. Say, here's the 2 weeks in advance, I paid it. So in these examples, really what you're doing is you're asking somebody else to come up on your behalf. And there are some hotels, like I said, it's very small accounts that actually do it this way, because somebody that has speakers come in on a regular basis, they'll have an account with a hotel. But I just think there's a few specialized cases where they've just said, can you come here for 2 weeks? And it's kind of a security for that third person traveling, is saying, I'm going to pay it all up front so you know that you're taken care of while you're here. And generally don't have a lot of problems with a lot of them, but there have been some specific examples where we've had some cases. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes. It just seems if it doesn't happen very often, rather than changing the whole landlord-tenant definition here, that it would seem like if it's only one or two cases that have occurred, that it would might be easier if the contractors would just issue a check every 6 days.
Senator Metzger, Senator Mona Sanderson. And I guess it comes down to, from our, when we were looking at this, we were kind of balancing some of those things. But I guess it comes down to the, when is it that you become a tenant? And I guess this is the only one, like I said, when you look through these different sections, that really only deals with method of payment. If somebody stays in a motel for 30 days plus, they should fall under landlord-tenant. But just because somebody chooses to pay 6 days, 7 days advance, I don't, to me, and a lot of the attorneys that we've worked with, they kind of said, well, that really doesn't establish residency necessarily, because it is a motel, it is daily service, and just because you pay 6 days in advance, should you be declared a tenant just because you're choosing to pay 6 days instead of 7 or 5 days? And, like I said, I think the issue from a landlord perspective, in my opinion, is, have you been there for 30 days? If you've been there for 30 days, I think it's a whole different topic or subject. And so I just see that one of the things that we've seen is this seems to be something that people have, for lack of a better term, figured out. And so it is something that I think people could tend to take a bigger advantage of, and now that they realize it, and I will say most retail establishments, if you ask to pay in advance, are not going to turn down the money, because it's better having the cash than taking the risk of not getting it later. Once again, after you hit that 30 days, then I think it's a different ball game and a different ball of wax. So really it's just talking about, in the beginning of the stay, it is method of payment, the sole determiner. In this case, it can be the sole determiner, and we don't necessarily agree with that.
Just follow up. My greatest concern here is for low income. With my background, I made a lot of referrals to sort of the lower type motels, and we do have a lot of homeless or that we can get in, or very low income that all of a sudden need to be put in. And I don't know enough about the landlord tenancy laws to know how this might affect those. That's one thing that maybe that we might need to consider. And isn't there a process? Isn't there a, I don't know if you want to call it a consortium or a coalition, a landlord, where they work out these issues. Isn't there a process in our system to work these problems out?
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Metzger, and I will say that, yes, this is my first venture into landlord-tenant law, so I will say that I know a few members of the coalition. and I saw him working on the mobile home park issue. And so I addressed both the landlords and the tenants from that perspective, and I don't know if it's a small portion of the group or whatever. And none of them seemed to think it was an issue. Obviously, like I said, I know Legal Aid Services is going to come up afterwards, and I know it's an issue to them. I don't, you know, I'm not very familiar with the group. I will say I broached it with both the tenant side of it and the landlord side of it, and they have told me that they did not have an issue. And I would say from the motel side, where I think some of the issues are that you've talked about, there are some issues where some people stay in motels for up to 2 years. And I understand, you know, it is a alternative for that. And I just think that when you look at those type of establishments, you know, once again, most of those people are staying there for an extended period of time. Once they hit 30 days, it's a different issue. You know, like I said, some of those guys are there for 2 years. Also, because they're paying or charging such low rates on it from a hotel perspective, you're not having daily maid service. Sometimes they come in once a week. Sometimes, you know, they come in twice a week. So I would still think a majority of those people are still going to be covered under the existing law. And it gets back to the, you know, from my perspective, there's a method of payment issue that's really the only one out of all this landlord-tenant law. It's the only method of payment issue. And you look at vacation properties, anything else, there is no mention of method of payment. So if you're talking 30 days, once you're there 30 days, you're a tenant. I think the law is very, very clear on that. And I don't have any problems with that or the issue. And if you don't provide daily maid service, which some of those low-income hotels will, then you're landlord-tenant. I don't have any issues with that. But all those are really what I would say physical property type issues and not a method of payment issue.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Bill. We may hear from you again. Let's hear from Mickey Ryan.
Good afternoon. Good. Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I have some written testimony you'll get. My name's Mickey Ryan, and I'm a housing law attorney for the Oregon Law Center. I have represented low-income tenants for 28 years in Oregon, first in Coos Bay, and for the last 23 years in Multnomah County. The Oregon Law Center's mission is to achieve justice for low-income Oregonians and their communities through the provision of free legal services. One of the central goals of our housing work is to keep people in housing and out of homelessness. Another goal is that housing be safe and habitable. I'm here this morning to offer my testimony against Senate Bill 636. The bill changes the definition of the Oregon Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, and that would have serious and possible unintended consequences for tenants now covered by the act. The act, as you know, is to regulate the conduct of landlords and tenants and provide for safe, stable, and habitable housing for all tenants. It passed about 30 years ago in Oregon, and it's gone through many changes, including adding this definition of transient occupancy. That was carefully negotiated, and changes are carefully negotiated before and during each session by a coalition of landlords and tenants. I don't believe this bill has gone through that process. One of the consequences is this bill would take weekly renters outside the protection of the Landlord-Tenant Act for the first 4 weeks of their tenancy. And weekly renters, there is a provision specifically about them in the act, and I'm not even sure how it would affect that provision. Because that has not been looked at. This is a serious loss for tenants that rent weekly and one that should be evaluated and negotiated through the coalition. As I said, there's provisions about daily and monthly rates, so any change to the act has consequences elsewhere. Transient occupancy in a hotel or motel has always been excluded from the act. The definition that the Lodging Association now wants to amend was added at the Lodging Association's request in the late 1980s. I was surprised to dig out my files and find that it was exactly 20 years ago at the 1987 legislative session when I first testified on this issue. I think we can all agree what transient occupancy in a hotel or motel is. It's when a person temporarily leaves their home on vacation or for business and checks into the Hilton or Best Western. And we've never argued that that kind of tenancy, of course, is to be covered by the Landlord-Tenant Act. But many of my clients do live in motels and hotels, often for long periods of time. This is their only home. They have no other place to go. I'm attaching testimony presented to the 89 legislative session because, as you can see, this issue went on for a while. Testimony from Michael Marcus, who was then litigation director of my office and is now a judge in Multnomah County. And it talks with great passion about what it's like for people who don't have protection of the Landlord-Tenant Act and are calling these places their home. It protects them against retaliation, shut off of utilities, and lockouts, as well as requiring that housing be habitable. When a family is subject to being locked out of their home and they don't have another home to go to without notice or the judicial protection of the Act, there's a high likelihood that the family will end up homeless. We must preserve this protection as well as the others for as many people as we can. I can't imagine any of the Oregon Lodging Association members are named in the attached Willamette Week article from 2004, but it shows that things didn't change between the late 80s and recent history. I talked this morning to an employee of the Housing Authority of Portland that administers some short-term rental assistance, and she confirmed that because we have very little family shelter in Multnomah County, this is where we put families 4 weeks at a time, if not longer. They also told me that they put people who have tuberculosis, who can't go into shelter, or have other disabilities that make it difficult for them to be in a regular shelter or transitional housing. They use motels and hotels. The Oregon Lodging Association has been able to limit tenants' rights in hotels and motels in the past by the definition that we have now, and this would be a further step in that direction. As they've stated, the reason is this administrative hassle of collecting rent every 6 days. I would like to ask that this, if this bill goes forward, that it be sent to the coalition, the Landlord and Tenant Coalition. We're a member of that coalition, and are many landlords, and have them review it. Often people will come to them or bills that sprout up elsewhere, and they're able to look at it as experts in landlord-tenant law and try to pinpoint the problem and resolve it in a way that doesn't disturb the other parts of the Act or make things not work correctly. The six-day reason, just to respond to some of the things that Mr. Perry mentioned, was picked because of weekly rentals, and that's why it's the payment of rent in 6 days. The vacation property issue has an additional protection, which has been talked about at various times in a hotel-motel situation, and that it requires that a person has to have another residence, another permanent residence. And so it may be that if the hotel-motel people wanted to add that provision to this, that they, you know, it would be traded for the six-day provision, and we would feel that we were protecting those same people, and it really is the people that actually live in these places rather than use them as a temporary housing outside of their own home. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Ryan. So just help me a little bit on this, since this is really out of my field in terms of the specificity that you have. So our current landlord-tenant law, designed to protect, you know, the rights of tenants in these types of situations, it actually... you can qualify under that act for something as short as a week or 2 weeks. I guess I'd always thought of that as a 30-day thing or more, but there are other tiers that fall under that.
Yes, Senator Metzger, if you can, it can be skirted with if a landlord it collects charges daily, collects every 6 days, up into 30 days, they can keep outside of the law. So that is a mechanism. You know, there is a way to use that. They have to provide or at least offer the daily or every other day maid service, but that will keep them for the 30 days outside of the act.
I guess I probably didn't make my question very clear. I apologize, but I guess I'm trying to think of more of what the intent is. I mean, is it the intent to find somebody as a tenant with a landlord relationship who's only been in any place for 7 days or 9 days or 15 days? Because I guess I always thought of that was there had to be a little, you had to kind of almost cure that relationship to a certain point beyond that.
Senator Metzger, I think there is a question about what the intent is. Tenant advocates believe that people in their homes should have certain process and certain habitability rights as tenants, even the first day that they move in. And if you sign a monthly rental agreement, you do get that. And so the question of having to wait, tenant advocates are very resistant that people in their home having to wait and on the first or second or third or fourth day being subject to being locked out. So there's always a tension between those things. And this is the what the statute is the compromise that was reached in that tension between the concerns that someone, you know, can get in there and all of a sudden assert all these rights on their first day versus, you know, how long do they have to kind of prove themselves and who gets that right. And if you can afford 30 days rent, then you get more rights than if you can only afford a day at a time or a week at a time or 6 days at a time. So I think that that's a hard question and one that we grapple with.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to, I understand the concern you have and I'm obviously sympathetic to it, but it seems like you and Mr. Perry are talking a little bit past each other here. Mr. Perry's really dealing with, it seems like to me, and maybe you can come up here and answer this also, but it seems like to me you're dealing with, he's worried about people who are clearly trying to abuse the system, because what they do is they have, there's this loophole, they can pay 6 days, and then they can stay for a couple extra days, and there's some issues like that. And if you could for me, if you look at page 4, line 16, it has two parts to this that's currently in state law. It says, occupancy is charged on a daily basis and is not collected more than 6 days in advance. It seems like to me Mr. Perry's problem is that some out-of-state company or some company is just paying for these workers to work there. I don't think you guys would view them as tenants because they're just temporary. And it seems like to me that Mr. Perry's clients would be taken care of, and I just asked this question, but if you left in the first part of that line, but the collected 6 days in advance makes absolutely no public policy sense to me whatsoever. If you charge on a daily basis, it wouldn't kick in until 30 days, but it's the collected 6 days in advance that I think is sort of the glitch here, and I was wondering if you have any flexibility where if you got the second half of that line, if you'd be comfortable with it.
Well, again, I guess I would like the coalition that's still meeting to look at this or for it to go looked at them later, because I'm a little concerned about what it does to the weekly rental issue, which...
Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm trying to get at is that I understand where you're trying to get to, and I'm not necessarily not sympathetic to it.
Right.
It's just that if it's charged on a daily basis, if you charge on a weekly basis, then you know it's a totally different kind of tenant, I guess, or a different kind of renter.
Right.
And I'm wondering if we can't kind of cut the baby in half by saying we don't want to catch Mr. Perry's clients up in this thing by trying to get around with an administrative glitch, because that's just expensive and difficult to get around. I'm wondering... It seems like to me the collected thing is the big problem. Is there any way to kind of work around that just from your gut reaction?
Well, I just, again, what we see is, you know, not the people who belong to the lodging association, but the people who are trying to skirt the law. And so they'll, whatever they do with the rent, they'll call it a daily basis. I mean, they'll just divide it up and call it a daily basis to skirt the law for the first. And I think if you the Willamette Week article talks about how some landlords have people move every 29 days. They might live in a or move out for one day and then they get to come back and live there another 29 days. So the problem is with, as you know, with any law, there'll be people on both sides who try to abuse it to and hopefully that's a small minority of people, as I think is true with with Mr. Perry's clients, and you know I hope is true with mine too. But that's what we see.
And one last follow up. I guess my point is, Mickey, is that I understand where you're going, and I actually am pretty sympathetic to what you're describing. But the people who want to skirt the law already can, and they know how to do it. And it seems like to me that Mr. Perry's clients are a different type of business with a different type of clientele that are basically being caught up because they're not skirting the law. Do you see? And so what's happening is that folks are still, as you call it, skirting the law or using this loophole. And then his clients are being caught up in what really is an abuse of the law in the other way. And it seems like to me if there's some way you could kind of help us with that, come to some kind of middle ground to help Mr. Perry's clients, it would be appreciated by me anyway.
Well, Chair Metzger and Senator George, we are in discussions with them. They're trying to provide us more information about the specifics and seeing if there's some kind of compromise that we can come to. So we will continue to do
that.
Well, thank you on that point, Ms. Ryan. So who are the key members of the coalition that on the
The John Van Landingham is the chair of it. There's two separate ones now. It's the Mobile Home Park is separate from the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and there's members from the Landlord Coalition's Norton Cabell, and I'm not sure who else. But
there's a lodging association.
A dozen. They have not been this time. The towing issue, for instance, got sent to them recently, so they get issues coming in from different directions, and other people are allowed to join. The towing folks came
in
to talk.
You indicated that they're meeting now on some of these issues.
They have only a couple more meetings left.
Well,
so
what I would like to do is, I haven't heard in our introduction to this bill at this point any dispute from your side, the people you represent, in terms of the intent of what Mr. Perry wants to prevent. And certainly haven't heard anything from Mr. Perry that he wants to interfere with the objectives of this. And what I would like to do is, and to see that the Lodging Association is participating in this, and I know Mr. Van Landingham has solved a lot of issues under his direction. If you could take this up quickly and see if there is a way to address Mr. Perry's issues on this without getting into areas that we don't want to get into, and maybe have those collective minds put together and try to get back to us within a couple of weeks on whether that can be resolved that way or not. I think that would be really helpful because we certainly don't want to have the unintended consequence on either side. And I'm not particularly desirous of trying to pick which side might have the unintended consequence at this point if there's an opportunity to have that discussion.
I'll do everything I can to make that happen,
okay.
Senator.
Is that okay with you, Mr. Perry, at this point? Okay.
And, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, it would be nice to know if you can go back in time with the coalition to see why they put in and is not collected more than 6 days in advance. So I think Senator George brought up a key point there. I mean, there must have been a reason, but who knows why.
I think Senator Chair Metzger and Senator Morris Anderson that it was to protect weekly renters and to make sure that they were included, so people that paid by the week, because that's maybe not as common as it used to be, but certainly was fairly common at one time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Public hearing on Senate Bill 636. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2279. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2279 came from the House on a 57-1 vote and unanimously out of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee. It's at the request of the Department of Administrative Services and would change the name of the fund so that earnings are moved from the video lottery games from the State Lottery Fund to the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund. You have a statute at your place where the other term is used, and the statute in question that's being amended should be consistent with that 461-215. And that's the purpose of the bill, is to make the terms consistent.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Linda Ames, you'd like to come forward?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with the Budget Management Division at Department of Administrative Services. House Bill 2279 is just a housekeeping bill that will resolve a contradiction in the statutes relating to the transfer process of the lottery receipts. Currently, we have one statute that says the Lottery Commission will transfer receipts directly, certain receipts directly to the counties. We have another statute that says all proceeds from lottery games will be allocated to the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund and then consequently transferred out. This bill will clarify that the distribution to counties will follow the same distribution as all the other lottery funds, which is to come through the Economic Development Fund and then be distributed to counties. This is how we actually do the distribution now, so this simply aligns the statute with current practice.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll see if there are any. Any questions for Ms. Ames?
Wow.
Okay, you're doing well.
This is good.
Don't get overconfident. Do you have any more bills coming up? All right, let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2279. Schaffler said this was easy. He was right. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2279.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move House Bill 2279 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2279 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? Ordered. Mark Senator Deckard excused. Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2164. Janet.
Oh, who's going to carry it?
Oh, I'll carry it. I guess. Since I forgot to appoint, it'll be me.
House Bill 2164 is also from the House on a 52-1 vote, and at the request of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and it would allow a holder of a winery license to sell malt beverages under a special events winery license. There is an emergency clause on the bill, and there's no fiscal or revenue impact. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Irwin and Mr. Conkling.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and the commission brings this bill before you today. This bill basically just clears up an inadvertent error or omission in the statutes that allows a winery that is seeking a special event winery license to be able to sell malt beverages with that special event winery license. And a winery can currently sell malt beverages at their winery, so we want them to be able to do so also when they have a special event winery license at a community event or a wine tasting or a wine festival. Those are the kinds of events that a winery would have a special event winery license. If we don't have this particular legislation, it creates sometimes a compliance issue for OLCC, but more problematic for the winery is it creates some turmoil where they either have to seek another vendor to carry off the event properly. For the community organizers who are creating the event, it creates problems because they can't they sometimes are stuck without having anybody be able to sell an alternative to wine should that be desired by the public. So it's a fairly simple bill, and as the committee administrator made mention of it, it passed the House unanimously.
Thank you. Mr. Conkling, anything you want to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Conkling. I represent the Oregon Wine Growers. We support the bill. We've come to see that in the evolution of mankind, people don't always realize that the top of the heap is Pinot Noir or other Oregon wines. It takes them a while to get there, and so we're just trying to help the advancement of good taste.
Oh, I see. Well, if the global warming continues, the Pinots will be up all in Washington, and we'll be into Chardonnays or something like that. Okay. Questions?
Cabernet, maybe.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sort of bringing this issue up because the bill is here to bring up. I'm getting a lot of concern, obviously, because I represent a good chunk of Yamhill County, about the situation we're getting in these areas where we have high concentration of wineries of more and more drunk drivers on the road. And there's a great deal of concern, especially on the weekends, with a lot of the agriculturalists who are dealing with equipment on the roads. We're having a lot of people who are dealing with basically people who drive out in the country. They stop at the wineries, they start sipping, they start driving around. And inherently, because of the way the wineries have been set up, because we changed the land use laws that allowed them to locate in rural areas and not condense them in someplace urban, they're driving from around the countryside. And there's starting to be a big concern on my part and a lot of my constituents that as we allow more and more beverages to be consumed at these remote locations, that we're starting to have conflict both with agriculture and then obviously with rural residences. And I guess my reservation is at this point, just because of the reservations I'm hearing from police, people in my district, agriculturists, there's a reluctance on my part to give wineries any additional ability to serve any additional alcohol out there until we deal with this issue of the drunk drivers in the rural areas. And I didn't know if you guys had an issue, because this has just been raised to me quite a bit lately.
Chair Metzger and Senator George, I guess I can only answer that we take those issues very, very seriously at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We do monitor wineries. The bill that we're talking about, a special event winery license, wouldn't be at the winery per se. It would probably be within a smaller town or even a larger town, probably location, but that doesn't mean that there aren't issues, again, for driving purposes from wherever this is. I'm not sure this bill is the issue that you're bringing up, but I certainly share with you those concerns, and I know the commission does too. Always monitoring these events is of key concern for us. We're trying to make sure, along with local law enforcement and the Oregon State Police, that people aren't driving on the road after these events, and that's a heck of a concern for all of us. I think we all share. I don't know anybody, including the wine folks, that don't share that same concern.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we absolutely agree. Again, temporary sales license events typically are in communities as opposed to at particular winery venues. And at those wineries today, malt beverages can be served, which is, I think, the reason for this particular bill. But I want to emphasize, winery operators take very seriously their responsibilities. They're business people, like any other proprietor. They have liability, so they take this very, very serious. It's not that I'm such a frequent goer of wineries and tastings, but when I have gone, I have been impressed by the number of people who have a designated driver or who increasingly rent a vehicle and go as a group. It's very common when you're at a winery to see a group of people who will either have a paid driver or someone in their group who is a designated driver and isn't participating.
Okay. Well, one thing I could say, Senator George, we might have an opportunity to solve some of that if we have an opportunity to vote on the beer tax to put more state troopers on to keep those bad guys off the road. So we'll continue to work on that part of it. I do appreciate your comment on it. Any other comments? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2164 and open up the work session on House Bill 2164.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2164 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2164 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I understand that I'm sort of swatting flies here as far as I understand this bill will pass and it will pass overwhelmingly. And just to consistency purposes, there's reasons for the bill. But I've just been trying to represent my district the best I can in the situation. And because I want to start raising this issue as a major issue that we're dealing with, especially those of us who have a lot of wineries in our, right. I'm starting to get a lot of complaints about it. So I'm going to be voting no on this bill. And again, I understand the consistency and the reasons why, but there's a certain amount of public awareness we can get sometimes by making statements on certain bills. So I just want to let the committee know what my purpose was to vote no, is that I just want to start raising this issue a little bit more as we deal with more wineries in the rural areas. And that's just what I'd like to say.
I understand that, and that is, in fact, very, very helpful, and look forward to you actually doing that because your point is very valid. Any other comments? Okay. If not, let's take the roll.
Senator Mon Sanderson?
Aye.
Senator George?
No.
Senator Deckard?
Excused.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2164, having received constitutional majority, declared pass, and you want to carry that? Or
sure.
Senator Starr will carry that. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's go on and open up public hearing on House Bill 2165. Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2165 is also at the request of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. It has passed the House on a unanimous vote, and it changes the definition of cider in one place in the statute to conform with another place in the statute, so that the definition is that the beverage contains not more than 7% alcohol by volume instead of 10%.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Sterwin.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Irwin. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This is a pretty simple bill for some reason, and I went back to legislative history to try to find out why we did have an inconsistency in two places in two different statutes as to the percentage of alcohol by volume for cider. In one place it was 10%, and another place it was 7%. After consulting with the federal folks, they use 7% as their standard, so that's the reason we decide ourselves to use 7%, because if cider makers are labeling and selling out of state, they're going to have to comply with that 7% standard anyway. So that's why we bring this bill before you today.
So just looking at the background on this, so those that would have more would be classified in the wine category.
Chairman Metzger, that's correct. They would actually be either apple wine or pear wines or whatever the fruit is that they're making the cider with. They would be classified as wine. The majority of those are pretty small producers, so they would probably either be exempt from the taxation or tax at a pretty small rate. I think the feds tax them regardless, but it's a very, very small rate, so they wouldn't change their tax at all.
Okay. All right. Questions for Mr. Wood? Okay, so we're moving cider from 10% down to 7%. We're going to call it cider, that is.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's close public hearing on House Bill 2165. Open up work session on 2165.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2165 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2165 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So order. Mark Senator Deckard is excused. Would you carry that just to the back-to-back bills?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
This next bill, though, I think it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah, I tell you what, we've got the ag people in our eyesights here. Open up public hearing on House Bill 2292. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2292 eliminates some sunsets that were placed on legislation from 2003 regarding commodity commissions and extends the sunsets on other provisions of that legislation. The legislation was brought because of a Supreme Court decision prior to the 2003, or maybe even at the beginning of the 2003 legislative session, questioned the authority of and constitutionality of mandatory assessments that were imposed under a certain mushroom promotion concept. The ruling was based on whether how much control the state had, whether it was more like a private commission that was charging these fees, or if the state had control. So House Bill 2292 was a long bill that brought oversight by the Department of Agriculture. Again, some of the provisions will be the sunsets will be eliminated, but others for the Wheat Commission, they'll be extended to the date of 2010, I believe. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Koba, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We have a very exciting bill in front of you this afternoon. And interestingly enough, given the folks in the room, this is a lot different from when the first version passed ultimately in 2003, when there was a lot of controversy around basically promotion programs, whether national promotions or state promotions, and a number of court cases being brought in different venues questioning those marketing campaigns and whether it was government speech or not. So in light of what was happening basically around the United States, working with our Department of Justice, we brought to you the provisions of the bill at that time to fix our commodity commission law so that commodity commissions could continue to operate and hopefully withstand any potential challenges to their marketing efforts. There was a sunset put on the bill in 2003, so we would have a chance to come back and let folks review how it was working, and I think that's the good news for today, is that I think people feel very comfortable with the way it's working now and are comfortable with removing the sunset and would keep the provisions in place. The only commission that asked for a little more time was the Wheat Commission. They were not ready to completely remove the sunset. We're fine with that. So we'll probably be back next legislative session dealing with the Wheat Commission component of it. But other than that, I think people are feeling comfortable with the way things are going and ready to remove the sunset.
All right. So we'll extend that for them to have a little bit more time on that particular commission at their request. Okay. Questions for Ms. Koba? I was in those hearings. I remember that. Yeah.
So was I.
I appreciated where you were in that hearing as opposed to where I was in the hearing. So,
yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Meisner.
So, you know, the Beef Council, the Grains Commission, the Alfalfa Seed Commission, they're all okay then. This is
Chair,
what
Senator
is fine.
Anderson, they're okay, believe it or not. 28 commodity commissions. I think we're going to get rid of two this session, so we'll be down to 26. And of those, the Wheat Commission wanted a little more time. It was particularly contentious within their industry, and it just gives them a chance to continue to sort through that, and we don't have a problem with that.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Mr. Dewey was signed up, but apparently he figured he would probably do more harm than good, so he left the room. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2292 and open a work session on House Bill 2292.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2292 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2292 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to declare a conflict of interest as a food processor. I'm a direct beneficiary of the work of both the Hazelnut Commission and the Hazelnut Marketing Board, which spend money promoting the industry, which directly impact me. And I do want to say this is very controversial in agricultural, but for the most part, the mainstream agriculture has been somewhat going along with the expenditures on this. So, but I do need to declare a conflict of interest.
Okay. Conflict so noted. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Mark Senator Deckard as excused. And good day. What do we have for Wednesday? Janet?
Who's carrying?
I'll carry it, I guess.
We have seven of your favorite Senate bills that now have amendments or have been worked out. They're not controversial ones, but seven bills on Wednesday. So this will
good. Hopefully we'll knock those out.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, members. We're adjourned. Thank you.